The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Just today is a sampling of the process. I'll share with you an idea that comes out of the process. We will begin at the beginning, but it is not there that we shall remain. Okay? We do the story of Genesis actually in other programs, but that's not what we'll be doing, focusing on this program, but that is what we will focus on, or at least begin anyways, for today. We're going to look at the book of Genesis. Okay? The book of Genesis. And we begin to read. Let's look at it. It's page 1. Got it? Bereshit, try and follow in Hebrew if you can. Right? Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Va'aretz haita tohu uvohu. And the land was without form, was void. Some explain this to actually be, it was without form, it was chaotic. V'choshech al pnei tahom, and there was darkness over the depths, or the depths, it's hard to translate. V'ruach, and the Spirit of God is hovering over the water. V'yomer Elohim, God says, Yehiyor, let there be light, V'yihor. And there was, in fact, light. Let's think about this. The question I want to pose is, what is the Torah anyways, thematically? We've just given it a structural, schematic understanding. I want to understand, thematically, what is this a book of? It's a book of stories? You know, is it a book of laws? Is it a history book? As a history book, it's not such a good history book, right? Because as a history book, there are certain periods of time that are mentioned in a verse. And all of a sudden, fast forward, we're just in a whole new age. And history books can't do that. And as a history book, it's not tight enough, because there are certain stories that go on and on and on, which historically doesn't seem so important. Historically, I could know this in a few lines, and yet the whole dialogue, for instance, of the servant of Abraham, Eliezer, and his whole dialogue in his relationship to try and convince that Rivka should marry Isaac, and it goes on, and it repeats, and it goes on. In other words, it doesn't seem to be a history book. Although, there is plenty of history in it, but is that the essence of what it is? Okay? Question really is, what is it? What do I expect when I read the Torah? What am I supposed to be looking for? Okay? When I read the story of creation, do I think that this is a scientific presentation of creation? I mean, if I read the story of creation in 6 days God created the world, I'm going to be a little disappointed. I'm going to kind of feel like, you know, if I really want to get into the scientific dynamics of creation, I'll read Einstein, I'll read certain famous scientists. I mean, is this a science book? Now, there is an interesting book which you might be aware of called Genesis and the Big Bang, whereby Dr. Schroeder points out the incredible, right, correlation between scientific data and the Bible. But that doesn't mean that that was the point of the Bible. The fact that I can show the correlation and the consistency between the Bible and history, or between the Bible and science, or between the Bible and psychology, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a psychology book or a science book or a history book. Do you follow the point? Okay. And therefore, it's important to understand that if I come to the Torah as if it's a science book, I'm not going to be happy. Right? I've got to always gauge my expectations to what really is there. Right? We talked about that. And so I have to understand, well, what am I looking at? What am I gaining from this? Okay? And so when I read this creation story, And it's very mystical, and it's very difficult. I can't help but ask myself, what is this doing at the beginning of my Bible? Right? I mean, scientifically, it doesn't seem to be adequate. There's too much detail missing. The fact that it correlates to science is very nice, but it's clearly not a scientific statement. Although it might be, and it is, and I believe it is, scientifically correct. But is that what it was there for? When a person studies Torah, and this particular passage of creation, am I studying it in order to understand exactly how God created the world? No, I'm not. Right? Although, how God created the world may in fact be lurking here. Right? But that's not the essential point when a Jew picks up the Torah. When a Jew picks up the Torah, they realize that somehow in this story, there is an ethos. There is a directive. There is a certain normative behavior that it is instructing us to adopt in our lives. When we read this book, it must be saying something in a certain practical sense. It must be telling me something about life and how life works and how I should adapt myself in order for my life to work. All right? So when I read this creation story, I ask myself, what is this doing here? And not only do I ask this question, right? But the truth is that the commentary, the famous commentary Rashi, brings in a midrash, now you know that lingo, brings in an oral tradition, that basically asks this question. Why does the Torah start with the creation story? Rabbi Isaac asks, why did the Torah start with the creation story? Why did it not start with HaChodesh Hazeh Lechem, which is the first place in the Bible where we have a mitzvah, right? A directive, which is the mitzvah to sanctify the new month. You might know that according to Jewish law, the time is determined by the moon, not the sun. The months are lunar months. And how do we know how the beginning of the month would be? Well, we'd be sitting out on our porch, and we'd look up and we'd say, hey, look, it looks like the new moon, right? You know, when the moon just begins to have a tiny bit of light, that's the beginning of the new moon. Everybody knows that the moon waxes and wanes, or wanes and waxes, whatever. But you know that it, you know, gets fuller and it gets less. And so, as the month goes on, the month starts off with basically the moon having just a sliver of light. It fills in. By the middle of the month, it is absolutely full, and then it begins to fill out and become diminished, and that's the end of the month. How do we know the beginning of the month? Well, we'd be sitting on our porch, and I'd say, hey, look, a sliver of moon, right? We'd run into the court, and we would testify that we saw the new moon, and they would cross-examine the witnesses. It'd have to be two witnesses. And then if in fact our testimony was accepted, the court would decide that today is the first of the month, and miraculously 2 days later you get your electrical bill. Alright? In other words, that was how it would start. Okay? And that is a mitzvah. A mitzvah to sanctify the beginning of the month. And that, interestingly enough, and that's a whole conversation in of itself, why is that the first mitzvah that we actually see in the Bible to the Jewish people? That's another question. But the question of Rav Isaac is, why doesn't the Bible start there? Why does the Bible start there? Now, where is there? There is actually in the book of Exodus. In other words, Rav Isaac is asking a remarkable question. He's asking, what is the entire book of Genesis doing in our tradition, as a written tradition? In other words, why couldn't it be part of the very rich, elaborate oral tradition? I mean, there's just so much other things that are in the oral tradition. So we have an oral tradition. God in 6 days created the world, and this is what he said. We don't have an oral tradition. But why is this in the written tradition? You follow the question, all right? The question, however, is based on an assumption. The assumption is, I mean, I could say, what are you talking about? What kind of question is this? It's a fantastic story. It's great material for a movie. I mean, what are you talking about? Well, you're going to knock out the creation story? You're going to, I mean, come on. Right? It's obviously beginning with a very clear assumption. The assumption of Rav Isaac is the Torah is a directive book. It sets the standards and the norms of our lives. And whatever in it has a certain ethos to it, a certain direction to it, a certain standard way that one should live their life. And therefore, he says, what is it that this story of Genesis tells me about my behavior in this world? Do you follow the question? And this is very important, very important. Now, Rav Yitzchak has an answer. Rav Yitzchak's answer is, right, that basically this is in order so that if and when the nations in the world come to the Jews and say, you stole the land of Israel, we'll be able to say, no, God created the world, and He can decide how He wants to distribute the world. And that is, I'm not going to go into that, that's pretty packed politically, but that's a fascinating answer, and it's not what I want to delve into today. But the point is that Rav Yitzchak sees in the creation story that there must be some ethos that emerges from the text, and the ethos that emerges from the text is the right of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. Alright, you can discuss that and what that means, but I want to share with you an insight from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in fact, passed away only about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. And Rabbi Soloveitchik was the head of a very famous institution in America, which you might be familiar with, called Yeshiva University. Okay, Yeshiva University. And there are numerous books that are coming out of Rabbi Soloveitchik's understandings, and I want to share with you an understanding that he brings in an excellent piece called Halachic Man. Okay? And this is what he says. He says that the basic direction of Judaism is creativity. The whole story of life is creativity. And the whole responsibility of life is creativity. Alright? That's why the Torah starts with creation. To tell you that everything else in history is the flowering, is the extension, is the unfolding of the basic theme of life, which is creativity. Okay? Which is creativity. What is creativity? The Torah tells us what the creative process is. The creative process is taking chaos and void and transforming it into order, lawfulness, and harmony. Right? And that is really what it's all about. Our lives and our responsibility, our task, our mission is to take void and chaos and transform it into order, lawfulness, and harmony. Just as God did. As it says, and that's the mystery of this verse, and in the beginning God created heaven and earth was in a state of chaos, formless, void. Why did God do that? I mean, is that the way to start? But that is the way the creative process starts. God creates chaos and a formless reality and then transforms it into order. And that is exactly the whole story. How everything out of this chaos is emerging, stamped with the commandments of God, let there be light, let there do this, let there do that. The formless, chaotic world complies with the will of God and emerges into an order.
Right.
And God stamps upon this raw, formless material categories and definitions, texture, identity, species. And that which God does is what we have been commanded to do. The rest of the story of the Bible is only the unfolding of creation. There are more and more levels of creation. Every day in our life, we encounter chaos. We encounter void. We encounter emptiness. And our responsibility is to transform that. Okay? That's our responsibility. At the end of creation, we have a very remarkable verse. A very remarkable verse. And that verse is just at the bottom of your page, verse 26. In the sixth day of creation, God is going to create man. And it says, V'yomer Elohim, and God said, Hashem said, Naaseh Adam b'tzelmeinu kidmuteinu. Let us make man in our image, in our likeness. And here we have something quite remarkable. What's odd about this verse? God says, let us make man in our image. Who is the us? And there's various understandings which are very beautiful, but I'm not going to share with you all the understandings. But I will share with you one understanding which is quite common, quite popular, and accepted, which is God is speaking to you and me. When we read this text, who is God speaking to when He says, let us make man in our image? He's talking to the reader, you. Who is God's partner in creating man? You are God's partner in creating man. You have the responsibility to create yourself. Right? To take the void and the chaos in yourself and transform that into form and to order and to lawfulness. What are the tools that enable us to do this? What are the guiding principles? Just like any artist needs some guiding principles in order to create form and beauty, so too Judaism says that Jewish law is the directives, the principles, the tools with which we approach the material called life in its raw, formless state, and we sculpture out of it a masterpiece called you. That is your responsibility. That is your responsibility, to become a partner in creation, in creating yourself. In creating yourself. Remarkable responsibility. And of course, what are the directives that Judaism claims one is empowered with in order to succeed in this self-creation? That is what Judaism calls the halakha. Jewish law and Jewish principles are our directives. Ah, of course. Two people go to art school, right? They are given the colors, the spectrum of colors, which is what we work with in order to paint. They're given paintbrushes. They're taught method. They're told certain laws. They were given certain principles. As an artist, this is how you become an artist. But each and every one of us comes up with an original piece. And that's the mystery of the whole thing. How we abide by a certain normative standard vis-a-vis color, vis-a-vis principles, vis-a-vis certain rules, vis-a-vis the tools that we have. And yet everyone, by abiding to those rules, still must and will come up with an infinity of form, an infinity of beauty. And that's the remarkable thing. I mean, to me it's remarkable. I'm a piano player. So to me it's remarkable how this scale over here, you know, selecting a scale is a history of music. Each piece adorned, each piece, perhaps, hopefully if it's good music, you know, it's the songs of angels that you've somehow been a participant in. I mean, it's really quite a remarkable thing. And yet somehow it comes out of a very rigid structure, you know. There's a very rigid structure to music. If you look at sheet music, it doesn't look like music. It looks like mathematics. It looks very rigid. It doesn't look like harmony, right? It doesn't look like beauty. It doesn't seem to show consistency. It looks like randomness. And yet somehow it's that form, it's that directive, which enables me to then be original. I and you have a responsibility, according to Judaism, to be participants in the creation of ourselves in the image of God. And what is the image of God? The image of God is uniqueness. Absolute uniqueness. And yet that uniqueness emerges out of a certain conformity to various laws, which is really quite remarkable. Really quite remarkable. How you can have a certain consistency in terms of the scheme of Judaism, in terms of the structure of Judaism, in terms of the laws of Judaism and the ethics of Judaism. And yet, each and every one of us, each home on Shabbos is a completely different Shabbos. You know? Okay. That is our responsibility. To emerge, to participate in the self-creation. And that is a theme that runs through the entire Torah. Now, Rav Soloveitchik says something which is very, very important to understand. Something when I first read, I found very shocking. Maimonides, the famous sage Maimonides, Rambam, in his Guide for the Perplexed, which by the way has been translated to English, a bit difficult reading, but important reading, explains something about providence. The nature of providence, divine supervision. Okay? Maimonides of the opinion, and it's a very important opinion in Judaism, it's a very well respected opinion in Judaism, that there is a different relationship in terms of providence vis-a-vis animals, vegetables, minerals, and the human being. When it comes to animals, Judaism, according to Maimonides, does not believe in individual providence, which is called in Hebrew Hashkacha Pratit, individual providence. What happens to an individual animal is not to be understood as some intended act of God as a response to the particular dog and his particular predicament, but rather God supervises the species. Okay? God supervises the species. And the species will continue. Alright? And God doesn't supervise, so to speak, every individual plant. But God supervises and perpetuates and maintains, so to speak, watches over the species of plants. But every individual plant does not enjoy an individual kind of providence. So if this particular plant all of a sudden loses its leaf, it's not as if like there's some real divine reason why that happened. Now, if it happens in front of you, then it might be something to do with you, but it's nothing to do with the plant. Okay? This is how Maimonides understands it. However, the human being is very different. The human being has the possibility for individual providence. Okay? Whereby based on my activities, based on my consciousness and my decisions, God responds individually to my situation and guides me and relates to me and supervises me as an individual. Now, Maimonides says something which can be for many people a very frightening thing. He says that basically, you as an individual do not necessarily enjoy individual providence. Not necessarily everything that happens to you is for a reason, right? But rather what could happen to you is a random activity that happens to you as a member of the species called mankind, right? In other words, what the Rambam is saying is that not everyone has the same level of individual providence. Not everyone has the same level of individual providence. Some people can have more, and some people can have less. And who determines that? You determine that. You determine the amount of individual providence that you experience and enjoy in your life. How do you determine that? By choosing to become an individual. Right? The more you are an individual, the more you will be under the providence of individual providence. The Rambam says that a person can choose to essentially be no different than an animal, and therefore rank amongst the animals, and will not have any individual providence in their life. But their life will blow in the wind. And they will participate in supervision, providence, only as a member of mankind, but not as an individual. And so therefore, certain events in their lives are happening. They're trying to figure, why is this happening to me? This isn't happening to you. It's just happening. Right? It's just happening. A person, through their choices, can ascend the ladder of providence. The highest level of providence is a prophet. A prophet has created himself into such an individual that he even hears the voice of God. He not only gets providence, he gets this direct directive, right? This direct communication. And Rav Soloveitchik explains that basically Judaism's goal is that you should become a prophet. That you should model yourself like the prophets. Now that doesn't mean you're going to hear the voice of God necessarily. Okay? But your responsibility is to model yourself according to a prophet. The question is, what is a prophet? We'll talk about it another time. But I want you to appreciate, this is a very serious idea. Very serious idea. And it's a very serious opinion in Judaism. That you choose between what Rav Soloveitchik calls two types of human being. You can either choose to be what he calls species man, which sounds like a superhero, but is far from a superhero, species man, or you can choose to be a man of Hashem, right? A man of God. What does that mean? What is the persona of species man? Species man is just an example of the species, right? I'm just simply a biological creature that belongs to the species called human being. I was born into the species, and I behave like the species, right? But what legitimizes my existence is only the fact that I'm part of this species, right? And according to our tradition, God supervises over the species. Just like He supervises over all other species, God supervises over the species called mankind. And mankind will continue, but I as an individual will not continue. In other words, there's a big argument. What is the role of individuality? Does the individual have the possibility for eternity, for immortality? Now there's no question that Judaism believes yes. Right? Because that's the whole foundation of Judaism. There's certain responsibilities that you do, there's certain rewards, there's certain effects. You as an individual are responsible, you as an individual are liable, and therefore you as an individual can achieve immortality as an individual. There were certain Greek philosophers that didn't believe that there's any meaning to individuality. Because the individual is really only a dim shadow of the universal ideal reality. And therefore, every plant is but a reflection of the ideal plant, the species called plant. But the plant as an individual has no real individual meaning. It's just a member, just an example, right, of the ideal called plant. The question is, do we, each and every one of us here, are we merely an example, a random example, right? Another face, but a dim reflection of the universal species called mankind? Or is there something to us as an individual? Each and every one of us as an individual. Are you following this? Right? It's a little difficult, but hold on. Judaism believes that the individual has the opportunity for immortality and eternity. Right? The individual has. The question is, when I as an individual pass away, was I just a flower that budded and wilted and died? Or do I have an opportunity for eternal existence? There's no question. Judaism says yes. You have the possibility of what they call Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, Olam Haba, right? You have meaning as an individual. This is unusual. This is what's particular to the human being. The animal has no meaning as an individual. The animal has meaning as a member of the species called dogs. Right? As a species called horses. but not as an individual. The unique responsibility of the human being, the unique opportunity of the human being, is to break out of simply being species man, simply being another random example of the species called human beings that work this way and talk this way and act this way, right? But I have the possibility to elevate myself and to become an individual, right? And exist in a legitimate way as an individual. I don't need the species in order to legitimize my existence. I can legitimize my existence as an individual. Judaism claims that the only way to do it is to fulfill my responsibilities as an individual. Question is, what are those responsibilities? But as an individual, the difference between species man and the man of God, so to speak, as Rav Soloveitchik calls these two categories, is species man floats along, eats, drinks, goes to work, drives down, right? This is all part of the species. That's what the species does, right? But how do I break out of that? Because I'm only existing as a reflection of the species. That's when I become cognitive of myself. That's when I start to say, well, who am I? And what is my task in this world? What is my destination in this world? What is my challenge in this world? What is my mission in this world? What are my responsibilities in this world? What am I liable for? That's how a person becomes an individual. Until the person recognizes, through self-examination and through introspection, until the person begins to say, what are my liabilities? What are my responsibilities? What is my task in this world? They have not become an individual. They're just another species. They're just another leaf on the tree. Right? And as a leaf on the tree, you fall off. That's it. Autumn comes, you're gone. Right? But the species will continue. Trees will continue. And I existed only by virtue of being part of that species. But there's no meaning to myself as an individual. And therefore there is no ultimate, eternal meaning to me as an individual. And that's animals and that's vegetables. Right? A tomato is a tomato is a tomato. Right? But a human being has an absolutely unique opportunity. Completely unique opportunity. And that is that the human being has the responsibility to become an individual, which is to participate in what we just talked about, self-creation. I take the raw material species man, and through the directives of responsibilities, which Judaism claims is halakha, through the tools of halakha, through the guidance of halakha, I create myself into an individual. And the more an individual I am, the more individual providence I experience and I enjoy. Now again, what does that mean? Does that mean like I have nothing to do with everybody? No, I'm still a human being, but I'm an individual human being, right? I still work within the normative rules of life, but yet, although we're all artists working within a certain rules of what art is, we all create masterpieces, okay? But this is very, very critical to understand. Because very often people think that Judaism is against individuality, right? You don't want to be an individual. It's not true. You have a responsibility to become an individual within the context of the normative, right? And that's the struggle over here, you know, whereby you have an artist who wants to break all the rules, right? Break all the rules. Just have nothing to do with these rules. No, I'm an artist, yet my paintings are very unique. My paintings are very unique. And so, when we look at providence, Judaism says that a person can choose to be like a beast, right? If they behave like a beast, following various instincts, without any self-examination, without asking themselves, who am I, and what is my particular contribution that I can make and must make to this world, and to this creative process, right? If I don't ask that question, then slowly, slowly I become a human being. And there are lots of species men walking around, driving around, and working around. But they have never asked themselves, who am I? What do I have to do? Right? And then what happens is that individual becomes, in the Platonic terminology, right, a universal of his own. There's the species, there's the universal man, But I can take myself and create a new form. A new form. If you know a little bit of Greek, you know, Greek philosophy, the forms, according to Plato, which are the ideals, they're eternal. And everything, you know, this particular plant, that particular plant, that animal, that are only reflections of that eternal form. Right? And is that true about man? There's the eternal form called man. And then each and every one of us is simply a reflection of that, a model of that, or an example of that, a random example of that. No. No. I have the responsibility to make myself as an individual into a form, into an ideal, right? As an individual. And that is a remarkable idea. And because of that idea, I have the possibility to enjoy individual providence, and I have the possibility for immortality. And that is a basic idea in Judaism. Basic idea in Judaism. Now, that is responsibility of Nase Adam B'Tzelmeinu. The process of taking chaos, taking the formless, and transforming it into an original masterpiece. Because that is our responsibility, so to speak. Each and every one of us is to become a masterpiece, which is, so to speak, like a piece of the master. Right? That is our responsibility. That is the creativity that introduces the Torah. That is what the Torah is about. Okay? And they say, there's a very famous piece about Yaakov, how Jacob succeeded in having his face engraved on the throne of God. Jacob is that man who is willing to wrestle with life. Who am I? Who can I become? What uniquely, I can't just like go along with it. I need to grapple with what is my identity? What is my destiny? What is my role in determining my destiny? What is my right in determining my destiny? And therefore, interesting enough, Yaakov was spoken of in the Midrashic literature as having his face engraved in the throne of God. What does that mean? I think it means that he succeeded in creating himself into a true individual, transforming himself into his own form, into his own ideal. He's not simply a dim reflection of the form called universal man. He becomes his own form. He becomes his own ideal. He becomes his own individual manifestation of God, an individual manifestation of the unique. And this is the responsibility. This is what, in many ways, it's all about. So when we're reading the Bible, this is just a sample of what comes out of it. And what's more important is that you get involved in discussing this. But today I want to give you an example. We started off with an assumption, a basic principle in Judaism. The stories in the Bible are not simply stories for the sake of stories, very interesting philosophical, esoteric ideas. There's much more to that. Every story has a certain ethos. Every story has a certain obligation, right, that is innate to that story. And when we learn that, we have to ask ourselves, how does this direct us? What does this mean for our lives? What does this tell us about the normative way that a human being is to go? Rav Soloveitchik gives us a very deep, important understanding of one of the major themes of Judaism that runs through Judaism. It's the responsibility to be creative. But what is the responsibility to be creative? The responsibility to be creative is to take the formless, to take the chaos, and transform it into form, to transform it into order, to transform it into lawfulness, to transform it into harmony. And that responsibility is something that we have to pick up. God created the world and left a lot of chaos left for us to fix, for us to form, for us to sculpture. And one of the major areas that we are responsible for is to be partners in the creation of ourselves. And the creation of ourselves is a responsibility to become an individual. As an individual, abiding by a collective rule, and yet by that collective rule, emerging as an individual, I experience individual providence, because one cannot have individual providence unless they are an individual. Animals don't have individual providence because they are not individuals. They are not able to deal with the self-examination, or the struggle, or the pain of really asking, who am I, where am I going, what are my responsibilities, what are my liabilities, what is my task, what is my mission, what is my destiny, that an animal does not involve himself in. And therefore, an animal is merely really an expression of that universal, And God supervises and perpetuates the universal animal world. The species continues, the individual dies. But in Judaism, it's up to you to determine that. It's up to you to determine whether you're simply a random reflection of the species, or whether through accepting upon oneself the difficult task of wrestling with the creative process, of emerging out of the randomness of being a random reflection of the species, but rather becoming a very original, direct expression of individuality, then in a certain way you become your own species. You become your own universal. And in so doing, you participate in individual providence and experience immortality and achieve immortality.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.